From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. In 1981, one movie ruined the careers of two fine actresses. The film was Mommy Dearest, and was based on a memoir by Joan Crawford's adopted daughter, Christina Crawford. The film not only tarnished the reputation of an American icon, Joan Crawford, but spoiled the career of Faye Dunaway, who portrayed Joan Crawford in the film. The film and the book on which it was based sadly obliterated the image that Joan Crawford had labored so hard and so long to achieve, the great American film actress. Crawford had three stages in her film career, her early ingenue phase, in which she was the queen of MGM, her adult phase at Warner Brothers, where she won an Oscar for Mildred Pierce, and her late period dominated by horror films, such as the classic Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Donald Spoto, the gifted historian and theologian, has set his sights on restoring the good name of the great actress with his newest book, Possessed, The Life of Joan Crawford. Donald Spoto brings to this book the same intelligent insight and historical perspective that we have seen in his studies of Ingrid Bergman, Audrey Hepburn, Marilyn Monroe, Alan Bates, Laurence Olivier, Lottie Lenya, and so many other creative artists. It's always a pleasure when I get to say, Donald Spoto, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary. I'm delighted to speak with you today.
You know, sadly, most young people today are unfamiliar with Joan Crawford, Mommy Dearest notwithstanding. What is it about Joan Crawford that compelled you to write about her?
Well, several things. It wasn't just the issue of a pathetic Mommy Dearest. It was the fact that when you look at the film criticism and film history, Joan Crawford is or has been generally regarded as a star. That is to say, a celebrity honored perhaps only for her longevity and the huge volume of her work. But it's my contention, and I tried to really prove this in my book by considering the merits of her films one by one. It's my contention that she's also one of the handful of truly great movie actresses of the 20th century.
Well, I agree. And I think each of her periods as an actress, she made outstanding films. And let's talk about some of her early work, if you don't mind, first. I think the movie that kind of put her on top was the silent film Our Dancing Daughters, in which she stage dives into a roaring 20s mosh pit.
Yes. Well, she had quite an apprenticeship, as you rightly point out, in silent pictures, starting in 1925 when she was 19 at MGM. And that was a wonderful apprenticeship and training ground for her, working with gifted directors and, of course, having a chance to demonstrate what she was so good at, which was a dancer. She had rooms full of trophies, literally dozens of trophies as a Charleston dancer and other, dances of the time. So MGM promoted her as a dancer and as a romantic young leading heroine. Very quickly, with the advent of sound in 28, 29, she proved that she was an actress of considerable range throughout the 30s. As you know, Gary, she was Clark Gable's leading lady in no fewer than 9 motion pictures, and with each of them, and he considered her far superior, far more gifted than he himself was, which is a very interesting sidelight. Their romance, which segued into a lifelong friendship, was extremely important for both of them. But throughout the 30s, she showed a range for comedy, for melodrama, for straight drama, and even for tragedy. And while she wearied of many of the scripts that Metro gave her, she also used them, she exploited them to advance and to augment her own talent. She felt that everything could be used to polish and to refine her gifts, and she took it with the utmost gravity.
Well, you know, Betty Davis, her rival over at Warner Brothers, was sort of famous for combating the studio system, but was Joan Crawford less resistant to the studio system?
Well, she always went on record saying that MGM was the place which turned her from, her own words, poor trash, poor Texas trash, into an educated and more sophisticated lady, a human being. And that is that those were the days when the studio didn't just put people under contract. They gave them classes and courses in poetry, literature, diction, costumes, makeup, dancing. They really put people through an unofficial major education. And Joan always said, I would have been nothing without MGM. Specifically, she praised Louis B. Mayer as a man who made her career possible, who was sort of the father she never had. Her own background was terribly sad and confused in childhood. And so she was combative only when it came to the last of her 18 years at Metro in 1942-43. She was begging for better roles, and they were not forthcoming for reasons which I set forth in the book. Namely that Mayer was now favoring Greer Garson and Judy Garland and Lana Turner. And in her late 30s, Joan was just taken for granted there. So she wanted out, and she got out and went over to Warner Brothers, where she did a couple of films and then, of course, became an independent. But specifically, to answer your question, she was not as combative with studios, except when it came to her insistence on good roles and her insistence that roles be correctly and properly and dramatically written and well written.
Well, of course, I always enjoy your books and I love reading them, but this time I had to disagree on a couple of things because some of my favorite pictures of Joan's are not your favorite pictures, so let's have a fight about Grand Hotel. I think Grand Hotel is one of the most wonderful movies that Hollywood ever made, but you're not fond of that picture.
I think it's about 40 minutes too long, for one thing.
Yeah.
And I do weary of Garbo. You know, I mean, it's a difficult performance for me to watch. It's so over the top. I don't think it survives. Whereas Crawford, as Slemchen, as this freewheeling secretary for hire, I think gives us a much more fully fleshed out, a more three-dimensional character. But that's the script. And, of course, millions agree with you that Grand Hotel is really deathless entertainment. I just find that after an hour or so, I am saying ho-hum.
Joan Crawford gives a very contemporary performance in that picture.
Yes, she does. You're quite right. And I think that the director and the writer and she together saw that they had to give it a kind of contemporary, slick feeling. Also, of course, in 1933, it was known what was happening in Germany, and it was, in a sense, you know, that picture shows us the decline of mere elegance in social life at the time.
It does have, I mean, technically it's a beautiful film. It's got these beautiful sets.
A set,
sort of a 360-degree set. I wonder even how they constructed it. And the costumes, not just that Garbo wears, which are stunning, but Joan Crawford has some beautiful costumes in that picture.
Oh, yes. Yes. No, this is MGM at the pinnacle of its technical wizardry. It is, from that point of view, It's admirable achievement.
You're just mentioning that her childhood was an unhappy one. Do you think that her accomplishments as an actress were affected by her childhood?
Oh yes, I think that her loveless childhood, her dirt poor childhood, her lack of a stable home life, of course, set her up to try. At the risk of being simplistic about it, such a background leads to one of two alternatives for a man or woman. Either they crumble under the pressures and the sadness of that, or they rise above it and make something of themselves. And in the case of Lucille Le Sueur, name changed to Joan Crawford by Metro, it was terribly important for her to make something of herself, and she did.
Do you believe she was sexually abused as a child?
I don't think there's any evidence for that. She never mentioned it, and of course she's the only source we would have. She never told anybody that she was sexually abused. She did mention that one of her mother's boyfriends and possibly a husband was a little, fondled her as a little girl a little too boldly. But she doesn't go into great detail. People didn't in those days. You know, they didn't go on TV talk shows or write best-selling books giving anatomy lessons. She did say that she was... She had a memory of some discomfort at being fondled rather too closely. But she didn't say anything more than that. So I think it's a leap to sexual abuse, but certainly she remembered something unpleasant.
We're speaking with Donald Spoto, and his new book is called Possessed, The Life of Joan Crawford. So when she went over to Warner Brothers to make Mildred Pierce, Betty Davis must have been thrilled.
Well, the fact of the matter is, Gary, and I take this up in the section on Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, as you know. The fact is that the rivalry between Davis and Crawford was created by the publicists at the studio in order to generate more public interest in their respective pictures. Davis and Crawford were doing very different kinds of roles, and of course in 1944, when she went over to Warner's for Mildred Pierce, Joan was 39 years old, and Davis was 37, but Davis had just come back from her humiliating loss of a lawsuit that she, instituted against Jack Warner. And she came back and was given a renewal of her contract by Jack Warner. But they were doing very different kinds of pictures. I think you're right insofar as Davis had fallen on bad times. The properties she was given in 45, 6, and 7 were really, in fact, until All About Eve, which she did for Fox in 1950, was, you know, the properties were not good. Of course, Joan won the Academy Award for Best Actress of 1945 for Mildred Pierce, thoroughly deserved. But there's no record of any, you know, unpleasant words or much less gestures on the part of either one of them. I mean, you know, they were both professionals. This is something everybody, I think, has to keep in mind. Both of them were hard-working professionals who would do nothing to embarrass themselves publicly or in private by setting up some kind of overt rivalry with the other.
Back to Grand Hotel for 1 second, since you bring up this idea of rivalry. What was Joan Crawford's interaction, if she had any at all, with Greta Garbo on the set of Grand Hotel?
Well, it's very interesting. She met Garbo once, very briefly, during the production of Grand Hotel. And as Crawford went on record saying, she was completely awestricken by her. And Garbo apparently said to Crawford that she was very sorry they had no scenes together. And that was the extent of their meeting. Hmm. But, you know, they were both... The two of them and Norma Shearer, of course, were the three big box office draws that Metro had. And in Grand Hotel, Metro put in just about everybody they had on a contract. You know, they had the Barrymores and Garbo and Crawford and Wallace Beery. On it goes.
Gene Herschelt and Louis Stone.
Gene Herschelt. You know.
Dr. Spoto, do you think that... You mention in the book that Greta Garbo made just a handful of films and was paid an enormous salary, whereas Joan Crawford made 700 movies and wasn't paid nearly as much. Did she have resentment toward Garbo or not?
No, not at all. Crawford, you know, was certainly a tough person, demanding more of herself than anybody. But she did not resent other people's success. When she was resentful, Gary, she was resentful that people were merely paid well without any talent to justify it. Mm-hmm. She also resented that Norma Shearer, as the wife of studio production chief Irving Thalberg, was given plum roles, often without justification, she felt. She really resented that, too. But that stopped in 1937 when Irving Thalberg, not yet 40, dropped down dead.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about Joan Crawford's personal life. She was married several times. Was she not really a marrying type of woman?
Well, you know, I've had the privilege of getting to know many fine, great actresses in my career. And a surprising number of them have said to me, you know, that they questioned late in the day whether they ever should have married or had children, not because they had necessarily unhappy marriages or were unfit mothers, but because at the time so much was expected, so much more was expected of a woman in virtually any field, but certainly in the acting profession, than of men. And those who really dedicated themselves completely and ferociously to their craft put it above a personal life. Sometimes that meant other people would suffer. It isn't that they intended it, but that's what happened. And was she the marrying kind? I think so. She did it four times, after all. And I think it's important to say also that she was attracted to men of refinement and intelligence and married them. She also, of course, had lovers who were in the same mold or at least shared her interests.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about her adopted daughter, Christina Crawford, who wrote the terrible book, Mommy Dearest. Do you think that Joan Crawford was a terrible mother, or do you think she was replaying the parenting tapes that she recorded when she was a child, or do you think that Christina Crawford is spoiled and doesn't know what she's talking about?
Well, according to, I think that among the, well, perhaps the most significant witnesses to the truth of the matter were the other adopted twins, the two daughters whom Joan Crawford also adopted, Kathy and Cindy, whose response was always that when they read Mommy Dearest and when they heard Christina's spoken memories, they said they didn't know who she was talking about, that their mother, the mother they knew, was the most loving, attentive, providing. Was Joan Crawford a strict mother? You bet. She looked around in Hollywood and she saw the spoiled children who got everything they wanted and even things they didn't want because parents just tried to buy love and raised a number of offspring who grew up to be, well, let's just say less than desirable. Joan saw that and vowed that her children would not grow up that way. So she was a disciplinarian. I don't think that means she was an SS guard. In fact, the evidence suggests exactly the opposite. And as I say, I think the primary witness are the other girls in the household.
Well, we're talking with Donald Spoto, and his new book is called Possessed, The Life of Joan Crawford. Her latter years as a horror film actress and television actress were also filled with some really marvelous performances. One that you mention in the book that I love is Steven Spielberg's first film as a director, an episode of Night Gallery.
That is right. Part of the television series. When Joan did Night Gallery, she didn't know who this young, 21, 22-year-old director was doing, and she quickly found out and worked very well with him. I just think it's very hard, Gary, to find a bad performance by Joan Crawford. And let's backtrack a minute. I don't think it's quite fair to say that she made horror films. In fact, she never made a horror film. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is not a horror film. A horror film is, as you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, this kind of thing. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is a soap opera-ish melodrama about two aging sisters with a checkered past.
But it's scary.
Excuse me?
It is scary.
Yes, I think it's... Yes, it is. I think it's more sad than terrifying. But the only other picture she did later on, I mean, she did that two dreadful films late in her career in England, one called Berserk, which was also known as Circus of Blood.
Yes.
But that's not a horror movie. It's just a murder mystery that's rather grotesque. And then that silly picture, Trog, about the unearthing of a prehistoric monster, which is so bad that it's funny.
Yes. But her performance is very sincere in it. You know, she approaches her performance in that film the same way she does in Rain or whatever.
Oh, that's exactly correct. And I think it's also important for people to keep in mind, she was an actress, actresses work, and she needed the money. Her last husband, who died 4 years into their marriage, the CEO of Pepsi-Cola, Alfred Steele, not only did not leave her with any money or property, he left her with an IRS tax bill and other debts into the millions of dollars. And when she discovered this, she didn't throw herself on the mercy of anyone. She said, well, I've got to pay these debts. I go back to work. And that's what she did, and she paid off the debts. So, and also, Hollywood has never been very good at creating or offering substantial roles to women in their 60s, with the exception today of talents like Meryl Streep, but certainly in the 1960s and 70s, there were not leading roles for accomplished women of senior years.
No, I mean, pretty much that's one thing that hasn't changed in Hollywood. I mean, there are the rare exceptions, but most actresses, once they hit 35 or 40, they're done.
That's exactly correct. I mean, you know, there's no female equivalent for Clint Eastwood.
No. Maybe Angela Lansbury or something like that. But even her, you know, I mean, she's not going to have a starring role in a picture. Or she's not going to be the one who carries a major film. There isn't anybody like that.
And Angela, bless her heart, I mean, a woman of great talent and great wisdom and prudence in picking her roles. Angela, of course, made her public name and renown through the great television series Murder, She Wrote, and then since then has given some magnificent television performances. She's one of the actresses who points out to people that when you can get a well-written television movie, that's just a great blessing. And in fact, today, it's possible to say that the finest entertainment writing to come out of America is really coming from television writers.
Well, that is true. I mean, when you mentioned, you know, that Grand Hotel feels a little bit long, pretty much every movie out of Hollywood today feels really long.
Absolutely right. I get the impression very often that Hollywood movies are written by teenagers for teenagers, not only starring teenagers. But there's some magnificent work coming out of American television.
I'm sorry, in a sense,
Joan didn't live to see that and be part of it.
I saw her in The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, yes. Did you? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, she'd try anything. I mean, she was up for television. Okay, I'll do television. That'll be interesting. I'll learn something from that. And she did those westerns, you know, for the Zane Grey Theater, and she did a great deal of television. She was busy until she became too ill to work.
And she worked on a soap opera briefly, also.
She worked on a soap opera briefly, and that was a very sad mistake. She was so nervous that she had a bit too much vodka before the taping, and it's just unfortunate. And she was also playing a woman much, much younger than herself, so that did not work.
We're talking with Donald Spoto, and his new book is called Possessed, The Life of Joan Crawford. And if we could just leave Joan Crawford specifically behind for just a minute, because I want to ask you, we've fortunately had
many opportunities to speak in the last few years because you're so prolific and you come up with a book, you know, every few months. Well, tell us a little bit about your creative process. Do you get up every morning and go into an office and sit down and write, or you must do so many pages a day, or what?
Well, first of all, let me say it's not quite every few months. It's more like every 2 years. But yes, I mean every writer has a different method of modus operandi, if you will. Yes, I mean I write every day once the research is done. The research for me is a longer process than the actual writing. The writing of a book is my reward for doing the travel and the interviews and the archival research and the studio research in the case of actors and directors. My reward is then once that is finished or almost completely finished, my reward is to sit down and write a book. And a book only gets written if one has, I suppose, what you might call a certain amount of discipline, and you get up in the morning and you go to work. My office is a room in my home, small but efficient, and the writer's life is not terribly interesting. You sit in a room with bits and pieces of paper, and notes and pens and a word processor screen, and that's it. But for me, it's been a richly rewarding career the last 35 years. I've met so many wonderful and gifted people, some of whom have become lifelong friends. I mean, that's an added blessing one never expects and is grateful when it occurs. I can only really undertake projects for people whose lives and their achievements I respect. I'm really not interested in writing about criminals or heaven forbid politicians. You know, I just don't I just won't undertake that kind of work, and I'm not capable of doing a sports figure or a scientist. These are not my gifts.
Well, so, you have written about Jackie Kennedy and the royal family, so in a way those are kind of like political stories.
I suppose tangentially, yes. Jackie was, of course, not herself a politician, but she understood politics, as she used to say, those men in dark suits. She would say about a party that too many dark blue suits. And the royal family of England, which is supposed to be above politics, but has its own internal politics. Of course, it's thrilling for me. By the way, one of the unexpected aspects, richly interesting, of living in Europe as I do, is to follow the European royal families, who of course are very different from the British royal family. Here in Europe, the royal families actually hold down jobs. You know, they work.
Yeah.
They work on behalf of the country. They're. You can run into them at the market and the store, and they're just, you know, really among the people and with the people, and yet they stand for the permanence of the people above any political party and changing fashion in history. So it's very interesting to look at the continental royal families that way.
When you're writing, how far ahead do you look? In other words, you did a Joan of Arc book, and then you did your Grace Kelly book, and I guess there was your Alan Bates book in there, and then the Joan Crawford. I mean, are you thinking, oh, I'm going to write this one, and then this one, or do you say, okay, I'm done with this,
no.
What will I do next?
No, I think that total focus on the task at hand is called for. Very often during the process of finishing a manuscript, an idea will present itself, or a publisher will come or call my agent and say, would Donald be interested in thus and such? And I will either say yes or no. I'm for example, working on my next book now, and it was suggested by the good people at Random House, but it happens to have been a subject I've wanted to do for 30 years. I'm happy to say that, and listeners can say they heard it here first,
yeah,
that I'm doing a big family biography of the Redgraves.
Oh, wonderful.
I had the privilege of knowing Michael Redgrave very well, the great Sir Michael Redgrave, the actor, and his widow, Rachel Kempson, also a great English actress. And, of course, they had three children, Vanessa, Karen, and Lynn. Karen and Lynn left us last year within 6 weeks of each other.
Right.
And but Vanessa is still thrilling people on stage and screen. It's a significant family with an important history of great achievement and involvement in the life of the world. So I'm thrilled to be able to do this. I've wanted to do it for a long time, but as I say, the suggestion came from the people at Random House, so I'm busily involved in that right now.
So in terms of your process of research, so part of that is watching all of the films. Are you now just kind of delving into this catalog of films of all these wonderful
films? Oh, yes. In the Redgrave family, there are no fewer, for considering all the members of the family, and that includes, for example, Vanessa's daughter Jolie and her late daughter Natasha Richardson, mm-hmm. the entire extended family. There are no fewer than 2,000 movies and television shows. Now, no book can take that up without becoming an encyclopedia. So one considers the major works for which the members of the family are known in a biography. Michael Redgrave, of course, made his movie debut in The Lady Vanishes for Hitchcock in 1938. That's how Michael and I met in 1980.
You were researching your Hitchcock work.
Sorry?
When you were researching your Hitchcock work.
I was researching my Hitchcock biography at the time, and Michael Redgrave, who was very ill with Parkinson's disease, but it didn't affect his mind, was good enough to give me a series of interviews, and they enriched the book considerably.
Wow. So that when will we see that, do you think?
Well, you know, there's always a long lead time between submitting a manuscript and publication, but I expect Random House will bring it out in early 2012, maybe spring of 2012. It's a big book, and we want to get it right.
And can we count on a visit from Donald Spoto here on From the Bookshelf?
With you?
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness, Gary, it's always a pleasure, please. You know, you are one of the best broadcast journalists around. I've told my publishers that, and I've told friends that, to listen in. It's a pleasure to speak with a journalist who has done his homework and is such a first-rate reader. So I thank you. You can count on our conversation when the time comes.
All right, you heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. The new book is called Possessed, The Life of Joan Crawford, and my guest, Donald Spoto. Thank you so much for spending some time on From the Bookshelf.
It's an absolute pleasure always.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank Donald Spoto for being our guest. His new book, Possessed, The Life of Joan Crawford. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.